Welcome to Beth Tikkun and our ongoing study of the Torah portions through the lens of the spiritual seasons of the year. This week, we are in portion Yitro. As a reminder, I have put a link to an outline of this teaching below the video. Parsha Yitro is small but mighty. This is one of the few portions named for a Gentile. Yitro, or as we say in English, Jethro, is Moses' father-in-law, the father of his wife Zipporah. Jethro is also described as the priest of Midian. Apparently he was an important person among the Midianites. In this portion, Jethro brings to Moses Zipporah and their two sons. Moses tells Jethro what God has done for the nation in bringing them out of Egypt. Jethro rejoices by saying, "Blessed be the Lord, who has delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh, and has delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods, because in this affair they dealt arrogantly with the people." So Jethro hears the witness, the testimony, and he rejoices. Jethro brings a sacrifice at the tabernacle, and Moses, Aaron, and the elders of Israel, well, they wouldn't have a tabernacle yet. They haven't built it yet, but he brings a sacrifice anyway. And Moses, Aaron, and the elders of Israel share that meal together in the presence of God. The next day, Jethro watches Moses handling the issues of the nation from morning till evening, and he tells him, "What you are doing is not good." I guess a father-in-law can get away with that, right? "What you're doing is not good." He advises him to set up chiefs that can handle most of the issues, bringing only the most difficult to him. Otherwise, he'll wear himself out, Jethro tells him. "You're going to wear yourself out." Moses takes Jethro's advice. So the next two chapters after that story with Jethro there are two of the most momentous in the whole Torah. The people arrive at Mount Sinai. Moses brings a kind of proposal to the people from God, that if they will keep his covenant, they will be his treasured people, and they agree. After the people ready themselves for the third day, God spectacularly speaks out the Ten Commandments, or the Ten Words, as they're called in Scripture, and the portion ends with a few other laws. I would actually like to spend most of our time today on the events surrounding Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, but we can't let the Ten Commandments in the beginning of the giving of the Torah slip by here. So what a scene that must have been. It would seem that because the people are still spiritual newborns at this time, God wants to do a bit more revealing of himself in addition to how he already revealed himself in Egypt and the short wilderness journey so far. He's fixing in their minds knowledge of his great power and the authority he has invested in Moses. So he appears in a mighty way to them at Mount Sinai. He's building their faith in both himself and Moses. The people have little direct knowledge of God to fall back on when the going gets tough. What they know of him is mostly what was passed on from the patriarchs and their recent experience of him. So God is gracious to provide other means to bolster their faith with this astounding, tangible experience of him. As they mature in their walk with God in the coming years and centuries, such a revelation as Sinai is less necessary because they know him better after walking with him longer. The more God has to reveal himself tangibly like this, the less free will the people will have. Who's going to say no to God who is appearing like this at Mount Sinai? You'd have to be an utter fool to deny him at this point. And it must have been quite a display. Before the giving of the Ten Commandments, God says to Moses, "Behold," you know, this is understatement, God's understatement here. He says, "Behold, I am coming to you in a thick cloud, that the people may hear when I speak with you and may also believe you forever." So he says he's coming in a thick cloud. It proves to be more than a thick cloud, though. So to start with, God descends on the mountain as fire. Imagine the northern lights from across the entire Arctic just coalescing together and funneling down onto this single desert mountaintop, covering the top of the mountain in fiery light like the world's biggest torch. The ground is shaking. The sound of a shofar keeps getting louder. Lightning flashes periodically. And God speaks to Moses with a voice like thunder. Imagine that vast fire that has come down from heaven and has settled on a mountaintop. And that fire is speaking to a tiny little man who is standing there in the midst of the fire on the mountaintop. That speck of a man is talking to the creator of the universe. And a whole nation is gathered around the mountain, just all around the mountain, looking on. Now, what an experience it must have been. And God explains why he does this when he tells Moses beforehand, "Behold, I am coming to you in a thick cloud that the people may hear when I speak with you and may also believe you forever." As we have been emphasizing in these studies, we are drawing ever closer to the end of the cycle of months. So we are reaching a point of maturity in the year before we again undergo a kind of rebirth at a higher level at Passover. What is this scene at Mount Sinai speaking to us now in this season of the 11th month? If we are reading about the giving of the Torah this week and in the coming weeks, this idea must be of central importance for us now when we read it. I want to make two quick points here regarding how we receive the Torah in the winter, right? There's a giving of the Torah. There's a receiving of the Torah that's happening in our Torah portion. It's actually happening in the late spring. But here, while we read it, there must be some sense that we are receiving the Torah now here in the winter. The first is that we are still in a season of diving into deeper levels of the Torah. Deeper levels. At Shavuot in the late spring, we celebrate the giving of the Torah. And on this side of the year, we are being enabled to go deep. This whole half of the year that is kicked off in the seventh month by special work of Torah in our gut and heart is a time that lends itself especially well to digging deeply into the inner Torah this whole half of the year. At Sinai, we are seeing the people absorb the outer Torah, the surface level of the Torah. With maturity comes the ability to dip into the sparkling inner waters of the Torah. So to flesh out this point, let me just list a few of the keys to digging deeper in the Torah. Some of these come from some things that I've heard Grant say over the years and just some personal experience and other teachers. So we're talking now about keys to digging deeper in the Torah. So first of all, we must give time to Torah study. You're not going to plunge deep without an investment of time. That's a foundational requirement. Second of all, we respect the Jewish study tradition, and we learn how they have studied the Torah for centuries. This doesn't mean we accept everything that has been written for 3,000 years, but we accept much of it. And just as importantly, we learn their techniques, their different lenses for studying the Bible, and we allow those techniques to augment our own Bible study techniques. We accept that God chose the Jews as his kingdom of priests and that the Bible is a Jewish book. Next, we seek out good teachers. We are looking for Jewish, Christian, and Messianic teachers who can both teach well and who have proven themselves in their walk with the Lord. Because in a sense, we want to absorb their way of living. And so we do absorb some of that as we listen to them teach. But we also want their Torah knowledge as well. So next one is we cultivate humility and a childlike faith. And An already full vessel cannot receive anything new. We approach the Father and His Word with the faith of a child that takes these amazing words at face value, and that's huge. Many times we just read these words and we don't really listen to what we're reading, but we take those words at face value as promises and more. But we also bring the adult understanding that there are many, many layers of meaning in this text. We also carefully lift some guards that want to box us in, like this. Like we might say, you know, the Bible is limited and it's like a normal book. I mean, we can hold it in our hands like another book, but it's not a normal book. It's supernatural. I mean, we have to trust that it's able to speak to us on many, many, many levels, infinite number of levels. So it's supernatural, and we will never get to the bottom of it. A child has a new adventure every day. We need to foster this spirit of daily adventure within us. Life is an adventure that we are meant to enjoy. And this sense of adventure leads to the final idea I'll mention here for this topic. We begin in gratitude, which leads to joy. Let me say that again. We sit down with that word. We begin in gratitude, which leads to joy. So this is one from Rabbi Trugman, and he's actually quoting from Rabbi Ginsburg. And he's saying that Rabbi Ginsburg says that when we seek to be inspired, we start by giving thanks to God for all our abundant blessings. And this gratitude brings us to a place of joy, and joy is the state of being that most lends itself toward inspiration. I'm using some of my own words there to kind of summarize. Joy. Joy is critical. Joy leads to inspiration. Actually, so I have one more last point here that I added in. And it is that we need to recognize that believers have been given the Holy Spirit, the Spirit of truth that guides us into all truth. The Spirit leads us supernaturally in our study of the Torah, and that's a critical thing. We need to pray. We need to pray for the Spirit's guidance in the Word, inviting His voice into our study. The Spirit is at work in the world and is enabling believers to go deep in the Word. This deeper dive into the Torah among Christians everywhere today, right? Everywhere I look, Christians are being attracted to the Hebraic root of the faith. That's a sign of the end times, because as you get toward the end of the cycle, God is opening up the Torah in deeper and deeper levels of the Torah. That's happening worldwide now. So that's a sign of the end. Okay, so that's the idea of going deep in the Torah in the winter, which is a form of receiving the Torah in the winter, right? We're reading about the receiving of the Torah on the one hand, so we're thinking about how we're receiving the Torah now in the winter. The second idea I'd like to connect to our receiving of the Torah in the winter is the reminder that our commitment to Torah is being tested now in this cold time. And so we will recommit to the Torah during this time of testing. We will commit once again. So again, the cold is equated with a kind of lack of passion, an apathy. And when we lack passion, we are weak and prone to slipping away. So let me say again that we are nearing Purim. And the real test at Purim is this question: will you stay in the covenant the Jewish people have with God and suffer the consequences of the evil decree against the Jews in Persia, right? This is the Esther story. Or will you walk away from the covenant and the Jewish people and save your life? So this was a great test indeed, because the Jews were separated from their land and their temple. They were surrounded by a bunch of different cultures. In Persia, those who were apathetic toward God and the Torah would have really struggled with what to do in this situation, right? The decree had gone out. If you're a Jew, you can, you know, your neighbors can attack you on a certain date. As we read now in this Torah portion about the giving of the Torah, we should expect our own commitment to the Torah to be tested in this season. And we recommit to the Torah. We take it on again. I mentioned earlier that God showed himself so boldly at Mount Sinai, so boldly that you'd have to be a fool to not agree to the covenant at that time. The truth is that they had little free will to choose God at Sinai. And one way they say it is that God held the mountain over their head and said, if you don't accept this covenant, I'm going to drop it on you. Well, that's because he was appearing so obviously to them. So according to some Jewish teaching, the people really chose God with the fullness of free will during Purim, when God was hiding himself. God's name doesn't even appear in the book of Esther, right? He's hidden there. So God wants us to choose him and his Torah without the light show on Mount Sinai. And making that choice for God and Torah while God is hidden is central to this season of the year. Now I want to back up a bit to spend some time with this somewhat mysterious figure of Jethro and his relationship to Moses. This supremely important Torah portion containing the wonder at Sinai is named for this Gentile priest of Midian. Okay, this certainly brings up some questions. And, you know, Jewish people have asked, why is this portion named for this Gentile? So I believe the key to understanding what Jethro is doing here is the marriage atmosphere that is connected to this moment for Israel. So many commentators note how the events at Mount Sinai are very evocative of a marriage to God, or at least one step in the ancient Jewish marriage process. I would like to suggest that running parallel to the marriage between God and Israel is a marriage between the Jewish people and the nations. And Jethro is representing the bride of the nations here. So there's an upper marriage between God and Israel. That upper marriage has a lower reflection, the marriage between Israel and the nations. We're seeing a picture of that marriage here between the high priest of Israel, who is Moses, and the high priest of the nearby nation of Midian, who is Jethro. So before we go deeper, let's look at Jethro's name. Yitro is the Hebrew, is thought to mean his excellence, but the root idea seems to be that of overhanging or excess or extra left over. And I like the root idea of overhanging here because to me, this concept of hanging over or extra or covering is marriage language. Some of you watching may have been to Mary Campbell Cave at the Gorge in Cuyahoga Falls, that large rock overhang where Native Americans sometimes live next to the river, there where the Great Falls of the Cuyahoga is. A ledge like that surrounds those who are sheltering under it. And in the Jewish mind, there is a sense that the bride surrounds. The bride is the home, and the home encompasses the family. And in a deeper sense, the bride is able to receive the seed. All right, so the bride is able to receive the seed, and within her body, she's able to fashion a physical body for the spirit of the child, the body that surrounds the spirit of the child. So she crafts the home, the physical home for the spirit of the child. The woman's special gift is being able to create the outside, the body, and also the home, to turn a house into a home that perfectly reflects the family. Without the outside, which the woman makes, the spirit has no way to interact with the world. So once again, Yitro means overhang or overhanging, and we can see in this idea of a physical covering a reference to what the bride is specially capable of creating. She creates the outside. In the marriage relationship between Israel and the nations receive the spiritual seed from Israel. Israel gives the spiritual seed to the nations. And the nations produce fruit in the physical world according to that truth. They build and shape the world according to the plan and instruction provided by the Jews. So once again, Jethro represents the Gentile bride. At least that's what I'm going to argue today. So notice how the interaction between Jethro and Moses unfolds in our portion. So what actually happens step by step between these two in this portion? Jethro brings Moses' wife to him, which is an interesting beginning to the story. Moses then tells Jethro about what God has done for Israel in delivering the nation from Egypt. I'm sure he told him, oh, there were these plagues, and you can't believe what God did. In other words, Moses witnesses to Jethro about God. Jethro receives that testimony, and he proves to be fertile soil for that seed. Jethro expresses faith in God. And the sages actually say he converted to Judaism. Moses then leads Jethro to give a sacrifice. And so he's teaching him how to properly worship God. Finally, it's Jethro's turn to contribute to Moses, as Jethro helps Moses with the practicalities of his life as the leader of Israel, right? Saying, you need some chiefs who can handle these smaller problems and just bring the big ones to you. So Jethro first absorbs truth from Moses, and then he helps to create a workable vessel for Moses to do what God has given him to do. It's interesting that God didn't instruct Moses in how to do his job in this regard, right? God doesn't tell Moses, here is how you are to do the job I'm giving you. God left it to Jethro to help Moses. And Moses was humble enough to receive that advice from Jethro. The whole series of events is an important example of the pattern we've been talking about in the year, in the calendar. In this parsha, the Jews give the spiritual seed to the Gentiles who internalize it. If it finds fertile soil there, then the Gentiles in their turn bless the Jews in a particularly physical way. This is what is happening on many levels over the course of a year as we grow in the Lord. He provides the seed of the truth to us, which we internalize, and we bear fruit in the physical realm in the winter. So just keep that in mind. Keep in mind that we're talking, keep in mind here that we're talking in generalities because we're talking about a pattern. Never forget, though, that God enjoys bending his own patterns. So we're talking about patterns. As we're talking about patterns, understand God loves to just bend his pattern or break them or throw them away. He doesn't have to function by his patterns all the time. He's above all that. So the bride is more grounded in the physical realm. So it's her special gift to be able to manipulate and control space and time, right? Home and calendar. Which are two fundamental building blocks of the physical realm. And as the cycle of salvation progresses, we gain more and more mastery over space and time, mastery over the physical realm. So we have noted in this portion that Jethro is particularly helping Moses with the practicalities of time rather than space. The woman's special connection to time can be seen in her relationship to the moon, which is the basis of the entire calendar. It's a lunar calendar. The woman's cycle is in rhythm with the cycles of the moon. It is the bride who is usually the one who is most gifted to handle the family's use of time. The man, on the other hand, is most gifted with keeping the family's spiritual connection to God via prayer and Torah study. Since the nations are like the physical side of the marriage to Israel, the bride side is the more physical side of that marriage to Israel, the nations are more naturally grounded in time and space and more skilled at building and manipulating the stuff of earth. And this is why we see a Gentile helping Moses to organize his time. Jethro helps Moses to become a master of time, so that time is not a master of Moses. And so what I want to do next is spend some time drilling down on the idea of being a master of time now, specifically because, as I said, with maturity, and we're in the 11th month, with maturity comes mastery of the physical realm, including time. So what does it mean to be a master of time? We need to go back a couple portions. We actually kind of skipped over a couple of verses in portion Bo that are particularly important verses for our whole spiritual season's study. So I want to go back and pick them up now. And let me mention here that some of the following ideas are coming from a teaching of Rabbi Avraham Trugman. And you can find a link to Rabbi Trugman's teaching in the outline below the video. The important verses I'm talking about are in Exodus 12, verses 1 to 2. So the 10th plague hasn't yet happened. They're still in Egypt. And God is about to give Passover as an annual appointed time. But before God gets to the nuts and bolts of how to keep Passover, we read this. This is how he introduces the whole Passover commandment section. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, "This month shall be for you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year for you." So, of course, it was Nisan at the time, the month of Nisan. Many Jewish commentaries note that this commandment to regard the month of Passover as the first month is the first commandment given to the newly formed nation of Israel. Okay, we see a few other commandments earlier, like circumcision, but Israel only forms as a nation within Egypt. And this commandment regarding the months is the first given to that newly formed people, even before they leave Egypt. So in the Jewish mind, this is a really important commandment that Nisan is to be the first month. The whole Jewish calendar grows out of this commandment because it is understood that Passover must happen in the spring. In order for Passover to not drift through the calendar, the lunar calendar has to be tweaked regularly. If the calendar weren't tweaked, Passover would get earlier and earlier every year because the lunar calendar is just a little bit shorter than the solar calendar. So this verse is the origin of the unique Jewish calendar. I said it was lunar, but it's not actually just lunar. It's a lunar solar calendar. It's a lunar calendar that is adjusted to stay with the solar calendar. Now, the Muslim calendar, it does drift through the year. So their seasons, their holidays will end up being in different seasons as they go on. But the Jewish calendar, because it needs to keep with Passover, and the first month needs to keep with Passover, it's a unique calendar that is both lunar and solar. So in a sense, this first commandment to the Jewish nation adjusts their perspective away from the physical law and toward the spiritual law, toward transcendence. So let me explain that. There's a whole new relationship to time being given here. And it's a relationship that will lead the people into being masters of time rather than being mastered by time. So this is because the Tishrei side of the calendar, right, the seventh month is that beginning in the year is the physical beginning in the year. Rosh Hashanah, the first day of the seventh month, is called the civil new year. And Nisan, on the other side, on the other hand, is the month of the spiritual new year. Nisan is about miracles, and that's what that word Nisan is in part of the meaning of Nisan is miracle. And miracles transcend nature. If the Jews were previously keeping Tishrei as the first of the months, and that's what most of the Near Eastern cultures did, the seventh month, what we call the seventh month, was the first month of the year to them. Well, if Israel was keeping that month as the beginning of the year, then they were emphasizing the physical beginning. But God says Now that I'm bringing you salvation, I'm setting you free, and I'm bringing you out of the kingdom of darkness. Now that I'm doing that, I want you to shift your perspective of time to emphasize the miraculous. The spiritual pole of the year shall be your beginning and ending point in the year. You will begin and end in miracle. You are now a people who will emphasize the spiritual law over the physical law. And this starts at this very moment that you are set free from Egypt. You are now a supernatural people, as all people are meant to be and will be one day. And that in that supernatural quality has to include a mastery of time, which is an aspect of the physical world. So the transcendence of time is what spiritually mature people experience. Time is not to master us, we are to master time. A slave lacks freedom in many areas of life, and one of the most consequential is time. A slave is largely not a master of the time allotted to him or her, and this is a great loss of freedom indeed. A child, too, doesn't have mastery of time. An infant or a child doesn't have a good grasp of time. They can get lost and play for hours on end. It is not until we get older that we learn how to manage our time profitably. So what exactly does it mean to be a master of time, to be a master of God's gift of continual renewal and reflection of his light? I have a few ideas I'm going to list regarding what it means to be a master of time. You could say to be a master of the moon in a way, which is constantly changing. I'm sure working together, though, we could add many more to this list. So, master of time. Number one, with maturity comes freedom from enslavement to the flesh, and this comes with a degree of mastery of time. So we have been speaking recently of Egypt as a picture of the physical world in general and of enslavement to the physical side of our being, the beast side, the flesh. One who is enslaved to the flesh loses mastery of time. So picture an addict caught in the enslavement of substance abuse, let's say drug addiction. A drug addict is not master of his or her time. They are enslaved by their flesh. And their master demands that they put all of their time and efforts into procuring more and more of the drug. On the one hand, the drug addict is literally spaced out a lot, probably not accomplishing much when they're high, or at least not working efficiently. On the other hand, they lose time because their bodies are less healthy. We all know how difficult it is to do anything when we're sick or visiting the hospital for this and that issue that keeps cropping up. And two, their money gets drained, wasted. And that means that time invested in getting the money comes to nothing. All of the drug addict's life gets poured into this dead end. And our hearts have to go out to those who are trapped in this condition. And to some degree, we are all still enslaved to the flesh. And God is bringing us through cycle after cycle of freedom. On the other hand, one who is master of their flesh also gains mastery of time. They are not tied down by all these time-consuming side effects of enslavement. They simply have more time available to invest in good works and growth. When a person is set free from that dark kingdom of physicality, they are moved from the kingdom of darkness to the kingdom of light. And light moves fast. In a way, Albert Einstein taught us that light transcends time. If we can move at the speed of light, says Einstein, time stops. That's a topic that is far beyond me, but what we can say now is that if we can move according to the laws of the spiritual realm, the realm of light, rather than the realm of darkness, then we can also master time and even transcend time. And so a related point here, number two, is with maturity comes long life. Long life. Living to a ripe old age is a kind of mastery of time. We read this promise constantly in the Word. Even in this week's Torah portion, we read, honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. And so that's in chapter 20. It's part of the Ten Commandments. Long life is something we should desire. This doesn't necessarily mean, however, that if the Lord chooses to take you out of this life at an early age, that you were off track. Only God understands his complex calculations for running the world. We can't jump to conclusions like that because we simply lack the ability to see all that God sees. But we should desire long life. But there's a caution here too. When it becomes clear that God is ending this journey for us, we need to be able to release it without trying to cling to it. Clinging to life and clinging to youth is what the world does. We accept the judgment God has given with thanksgiving and grace. But it is good to desire a long life filled with service and growth and an ever-deepening relationship with God. And he promises us long life if we follow his commandments. Number three, so we're talking again about how we are masters of time and how that happens with maturity. Number three, with maturity comes wisdom for practically managing our time. So knowing how to practically manage the time given to us is a kind of wisdom that comes with spiritual maturity. As we mature, we develop an increased ability to apply our minds to our use of time. So when you're a teenager, you might think it's natural and fun to stay up until 2 a.m. babbling with your friends, usually about nothing terribly profound, although sometimes it is profound. And maybe that's okay for a teen to indulge like that occasionally when they are taking a break from school, let's say. We create some lasting bonds in life doing silly things like that, and that's important. But as a way of life in general, it's not a great use of time. It makes a person less capable of doing good in the world. The master of time knows when to go to bed, when to wake up, how long to work, how long to spend time with family, how fancy the yard can be, which takes time, and what is the appropriate balance between the taste of our meals and how much time it takes to prepare them, and how much time is useful for relaxation so we can be recharged, so many other practical aspects of managing time. This comes with maturity. Number four in our list of being a master of time, with maturity comes a balance of spiritual and material uses of time. So not only will a mature person know how to manage time in practical ways, but they'll also know how to distribute their time between the more spiritual uses of time and the action-oriented uses of time. So we're talking about, on the one hand, the mostly spiritual pursuits of prayer and study and worship. And on the other hand, the active pursuits of working and shaping and building in this world. And that is the usual pattern. The spiritual pursuits are given priority first in the day when our mind is less cluttered. And the building of the world comes second. This is a daily challenge for working people and people with young children especially. And another part of that challenge comes from the fact that nearly all of us are not living in a Torah-centered culture, a place like Israel, where the culture has a Torah heartbeat. So the culture itself is not set up to make it easy to prioritize prayer and Shabbat and the other Moedim. So we have to be creative, but we simply must find a way to give priority to our connection to God in prayer and study of the Torah and God's special days. Now, of those special days, the cornerstone of the Moedim and the first one to be described in the list of Moedim in Leviticus 23 is the Shabbat. The keeping of the weekly Sabbath on God's appointed day for it is an absolute cornerstone of being a master of time. On Shabbat, we say that God rules all and is our provider and sustainer. And with this knowledge, we are able to rest in him. We don't have to be a slave to time. We can stop and receive the gift of rest that he gives. Again, we rule time and time does not rule us. We enter into that sweet freedom of the Shabbat. And one thing I have found in my life is that when I put God first and maybe sacrifice a bit of money to do that, He makes everything run smoother and last longer. My car breaks down less, my house has fewer issues to deal with, and I'm generally healthy. It's like God says, okay, in order to follow me wholeheartedly, you didn't work on Shabbat, or you gave up a job that you liked, or you spent time on a good deed and set your work aside. And I'm not going to let you fall because of that. I'm going to make sure that your money is enough for what you need. And how much time do we spend on car and home repairs and on going to the doctor? Imagine if you could just have that time back that you spend on house and car and doctor visits. I can truly say today that I have found God to be faithful in this. And it has not only kept my finances healthy, but it has literally given me more time. Now, I would just, you know, ask Him to kind of touch my grass so that it stops growing, because I'm spending far too much time mowing, but that's another story. Okay, number five, with the maturity, time flies. With maturity, time flies. So this idea is a bit deep. I'll say it this way. One who has a positive mindset, a doggedly faith-based perspective on life, experiences time much differently than someone who is constantly fearful and who sees life as one big disappointment after the next until you die. By developing a faith-based, positive perspective, time seems to pass quickly and much more enjoyably and is much more life-giving. In other words, our consciousness affects our experience of time. Rabbi Trugman gives the example of two teenagers who go off to summer camp, and they get to the last day of camp, and one teenager says, "What? Already over? We just got here." And the other one says, "Finally, this has been the longest week of my life. Get me out of here." The two teens' differing mindsets affected how they related to time. Their mindsets affected both their experience of the quality of what happened and their experience of the speed of time. For the one with the positive mindset, life is going by at the speed of light. It's quick. And the speed is a quality of the spiritual realm where light comes from. For the one with the negative mindset, time passes slowly. And this groundedness in time is a quality of the physical realm. We all know what it's like to feel like time is absolutely stretching out unendingly. So it's a daily challenge for us to maintain a divine perspective, that faith-based perspective. The mature person will be able to keep their mind in that place of faith and positivity and even excitement for what the day has to offer. And time will pass quickly and enjoyably for that person. They will look at a new day as a new adventure rather than one more endless grind of the wheel. God's personal name, the four-letter tetragrammaton, is composed of the letters that spell out to be in the past, present, and future. For God, these are happening at the same time. He transcends time. And when we maintain a godly perspective on life, we too can transcend time to some degree. We are made in His image, and He wants us to transcend time like He does. So one more here. With knowledge of the spiritual seasons comes a degree of mastery of time. Understanding the calendar God has given us is an aspect of being a master of time. The great Torah scholars within Israel were said to come especially from the tribe of Issachar, and their focus was apparently understanding the calendar. God is renewing us and renewing us over and over again through His various spiritual seasons and Moedim. We are walking along the path called salvation, and it is a path of constant renewal. This repeated renewal is one of the main characteristics of the moon, which again is the basis of the calendar. The moon is always changing, either waxing or waning, sometimes disappearing entirely, only to be reborn again as a tiny sliver. And so by God's design, at the root of time for us, at the root of time for the redeemed, is this idea of constant renewal. And the more we understand about how God has designed his calendar, the more we understand how he renews us, and the more we can get in tune with that renewal process. It is a growth process that we are totally immersed in. It's the air we breathe, right? We're swimming in time. And another name for this growth process, this renewal process, is salvation, which in Hebrew is Yeshua. So the more we can learn about this process via the calendar, the more we get to know Yeshua. And speaking of Yeshua, let's say a few words now about Yeshua and time. First, it is by the blood of the Lamb that we are set free from enslavement to the flesh, which so saps our time, right? We talked about addiction there. Yeshua is the key to freedom from enslavements like intellectual pride, emotional instability, and physical addiction. Through Yeshua's blood, these are conquered. As for practically managing time, Yeshua never seemed to worry about what needed to get done. He put the kingdom of God first, and what needed to get done, got done. We see Yeshua spending time in both the realms of the more spiritual and physical pursuits. He spent 40 days in the wilderness before choosing his disciples, right? He was in prayer during those 40 days, the spiritual pursuit of prayer. And we often see him withdrawing to pray. We see him as a youth drawn to the teachers and Torah study, asking questions, right? Another spiritual pursuit, Torah study. We see him attending synagogue services, worshiping God. And on the other hand, we also see him eating and drinking with those he was ministering to. And we see him spending much time healing and teaching. Yeshua calls himself Lord of the Sabbath, and he brings correction to the somewhat skewed perspective of Shabbat that the culture of the time had. Yeshua taught much about time through his use of parables like those relating to farming. Truly, in Yeshua is every aspect of the mastery of time. He is our ultimate example of this. Well, lastly, now let's turn to Joshua 9, the Gibeonite deception. The Gibeonites lived near Jerusalem. They see the writing on the wall that their days are numbered. So they craftily convince Joshua and the elders that they are from a distant land, and they express the desire to enter into a covenant relationship with Israel, which Israel does. When their deception is discovered, they cannot be killed because of the covenant. In fact, that covenant requires that if Gibeon is being attacked, Israel will come to their rescue and vice versa. And we will see Israel do this in the next chapter, swooping in to save the Gibeonites when they are attacked by their neighbors. So the leaders of Israel decide to spare the Gibeonites, but they make them servants for the tabernacle, cutters of wood and drawers of water for the house of God. The Gibeonites deserve some respect here. Now, what they did was deceiving, right? And so on maybe the primary level, what they did was wrong. But they do deserve some respect here. Not only did they survive, but they were given positions at the tabernacle. They were lowly positions, but they served right there at the heart of Israel. And they lived when so many others died. In a way, the Gibeonites are in a feminine position in relation to Israel, since they are Gentiles from the nations. Those of us who are Gentiles can take a few important lessons from them. First, we can recognize that God is with Israel in a special way, and that never changes. The Gibeonites see that they are not fighting for their lives against Israel, but against the God who stands behind Israel. Gibeon could have tried to band together with other Canaanite cities to attack Israel, but they were wise enough to recognize that they weren't going to be fighting the people, really. They were going to be fighting the God who took Israel out of Egypt and parted the waters for them twice, the God who caused the walls of mighty Jericho to fall. So a second lesson for the nations here is that we need to humbly accept that the role for the Gentiles is not the same as the role for the Jews. The humility of the Gibeonites is remarkable and praiseworthy here. So in the next chapter of Joshua, Gibeon is described as a great city, like one of the royal cities, and all its men were warriors. There's a greatness here when a city of warriors is able to recognize that all their skills will come to nothing against God's people. When their deception is found out and Joshua tells them what the leaders of Israel had decided regarding making them servants in the tabernacle, they answer, "Behold, we are in your hand. Whatever seems good and right in your sight to do to us, do it." These are warriors saying this, agreeing to become servants, slaves. It is only when we accept the position and identity God has given us that we will be fully on the path of life. It might be a role that comes with lesser glory, but it is the role for which we are designed, and nothing else will fit us quite right. Lastly, let's understand that we do have a role to play to help the Jews. This role is not without dignity. The Jews are in an intercessory role, a nation of priests, and the Gentiles build the world and make it run smoothly. The nations support Israel financially. We are receivers of the wisdom Israel is given to pass along. One of the most fascinating examples of the Gentile role in relation to the Jews is the fact that both temples were mostly built with Gentile hands, according to the Jewish plan. It was the Gentiles who had the skills to build the temples. And even when the temple is renovated, it is again Gentiles who do the work. So we see that the nations make the physical container, the outside, like the bride does. This is the special skill that only the woman can do. So we'll leave it there today. Thanks for listening. May God make us people who dig deep into his Torah, people who are masters of time and rise above the boundaries of time, and people who support the Jewish leadership, the Jewish groom, in whatever ways we can. And may he make us into the people he wants us to be. Shalom.